6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
And good afternoon. My name is Norman Stockwell. I am your host of A Public Affair. Today we're going to be speaking with historian Paul Buell about an exciting new 50th anniversary edition of Radical America Comics. And then next week, we'll be speaking with French cultural historian Sylvie Laurent about her fabulous new book on Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign of 1968. So that's my life for the next couple of weeks. I hope you will join me for both of those episodes. Let's dive in. Paul Buell, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you very much, Norm.
Paul Buell, a legendary radical historian who cut his teeth here in Madison in the late 1960s and early 70s, left us for the wilds of the East Coast for many, many years, and then relocated here with his wife, fellow historian Mary Jo Buell, and has been an active part of our community ever since. The book Radical America Comics, just out, is in part a revisiting of that radical history, and in part is a commemoration, I guess, that has the entire January 1969 edition of Radical America magazine reprinted here in comic form. The original, of course, was on newsprint.
and cost 50 cents.
Right. But I just want to read this from the foreword by Jay Kinney. He starts out, buckle your seatbelt and fire up your time machine. You're about to blast yourself back nearly 50 years to a simpler time when America was at war, the country was polarized, a crazed and despised president was in charge, cops were considered racist pigs, cannabis was omnipresent, and young radicals feared that fascism was imminent. Wait a second. What year is this anyway? So, what about that? Let's start there. Radical America, a magazine for its time in 1969, but also a magazine for its time today.
Well, it's a real Madison story. Paul Soglin took a look at Radical America Comics' new edition and said, this is what makes Madison different. People were arguing about all kinds of distant theories of distant places around the country, and often splitting organizations and wanting to throw brickbats at each other and so forth. And that was a little bit true in Madison, but Madisonian radicals never lost their sense of humor, and they liked comics a lot. And as I always say, when the winter got really, really cold, it was too cold to spend too much time outside picketing. So you had to come inside and do some serious work in the library, or maybe go to a friend's house and smoke a J and read some comics.
Let's talk about the magazine itself, because this Radical America Comics was just one issue of a magazine that had a long life. And Jay Kinney in his foreword describes you, Paul, it says, Buell, a history grad student, had a grasp of the sweep of American radical politics from the early 1800s through the 1960s era, something which most other SDS members lacked, but he also had a yearning to make the past relevant to the present.
Well, that's right. Radical America starts in 1967, and it starts in the Midwest with a strong regional sensibility that you wouldn't need to go to Beijing or Moscow or some other distant spot to find a radical tradition and some ideas about what to do. You could look right at home and find all sorts of things. The second issue featured stuff about the industrial workers, the World Wobblies, by the aged general secretary of the Wobblies himself. And in the next few years, there were many features that included the rise of black labor organizations, the rise of feminist organizations, and the rediscovery of women's history, in which Mary Jo Buell played a big role, and lots of stuff on popular culture. Michael Lisi's photographs from the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Poetry by Etheridge Knight, who was in prison in Indiana at the time and was soon to become a really famous black poet. poetry by Diana DePrima, who had been the queen of the beatniks and was delivering new radical messages through poetry and a lot of other things. But at the core of the magazine were also histories and present-day documentation of things that could be called American radicalism.
My guest is Paul Buell. He is founder and instigator of Radical America magazine. He's the producer of Radical America Comics in 1969, which has now reappeared as a special commemorative 50th anniversary volume from PM Press. Let's talk about this convergence, this meeting of the minds, if you will, of Radical America, this magazine about, it's sort of intellectual magazine, if you will, you know, about history, about radical movements, with comics that were themselves just sort of emerging in a new form.
Well, one of the, our printer printed one sheet at a time. A group of people, usually SDSers, would collate folds and staple them and help me put them into envelopes and take them to the post office every 2 months. 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 copies. It was quite a primitive operation for anyone to imagine today. But the printer was Henry Hoslock, who was a leading figure in the Teaching Assistants Association. And generally, it was part of a wonderful community of left-wing historians, some of them European historians, most of them U.S. historians, who were discovering all sorts of things, the history of labor, anti-war, black history, and so forth, in front of me, and all together talking about these things, forming study classes about these things, all with a wonderful idea that knowing about this history could make a difference not only to ourselves and our social movement, but also to the present and the future. Now, I want to add to that, the Underground Press makes a sudden appearance. It's a remarkable journalistic phenomenon because the layout is done by amateurs. Poems or strange photographs might appear on the front page, or wonderful artistic drawings by some local person. Reportage on the Vietnam War and the social movements at home that were not available in the New York Times, nor anywhere else in that era before social media. And within the pages of these underground newspapers, of which there were several hundred, all appearing more or less within several years, all sold for a dime or a quarter on the campus or elsewhere, within them appeared these comics. And they were iconoclastic in the extreme. Some of them were sexual. Some of them were about direct struggle. Some of them were purely artistic without any political theme. They were completely uncensored, which is something new in American comic art. And the person the artist who was most beloved by most readers happened to be this fellow, a history graduate student dropout at the University of Texas in Austin, Gilbert Shelton. He invented characters called the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, who got along through life smoking dope, having fun, and being chased by narcotics officers very frequently in Austin, Texas, other parts of Texas. But then with Gilbert Shelton himself moving to San Francisco, where a new underground comics world was emerging with dozens of artists, including some very famous women artists publishing their own underground comics, and a whole wild emergence of a new form of comic art, not only uncensored, but militantly ecological, anti-war, feminist, and in ways that had just not even been imagined that comic art could be. It made a permanent dent in the history of comic art. And you think about Art Spiegelman, you think about Bill Griffith, and dozens of others who became very major figures in what's regarded today as the canon of American comics. It was all taking place, and it never cost more than 50 cents an issue, and hardly anybody could make a living out of it, but rents were a lot cheaper. So I happened to meet Gilbert by writing to him after I saw a comic that he published, self-published, called Heads and Feds. I think the topic suggests the contents, in Texas. And I was very excited about it, and I ordered 10 copies and sold them at the SDS table in the Memorial Union. That was my introduction to activity with Gilbert Shelton. And then I received $2,000 from an old left foundation that had some money that had come from a patent on bra snaps that that had been expired. But there was still some money left in that account. And got a couple thousand bucks and passed them on to Gilbert. And Rip Off Press, which published this comic, was either the first or the second company, so-called company, it hardly existed, to actually publish and distribute underground comics. Within 3 years, there were a dozen companies, all of them tiny. But this one was new by Gilbert and several friends, and mostly all guys from Austin, Texas, who had their own take on a wide variety of things. But if it was anything, it was deeply American radicalism.
Our conversation today with Paul Buell, historian and producer of Radical Comics, both 50 years ago in 1969 and again today. Paul has been, in fact, you've been employing some of those artists from those days in some of your more recent graphic biographies. I know Sharon Rudolph, for one, is one of the artists that has appeared in some of your books.
That's right. And Spain Rodriguez, the late, yes, Spain Rodriguez, who was one of the great figures publicizing the Mime Theater in California, and writing and drawing a number of many wonderful books, including Che, which he did under my editorship, a wonderful graphic biography of Che Guevara. Sharon Rudolph, who I helped to bring out a biography of Emma Goldman, and now in the works, a biography of Paul Robeson, the great black singer and political figure. I managed it by 2005 to come back to comics and to regather a few of these artists along with young artists and begin a new venture of comics with Wobblies, a graphic history of the IWW on its centenary. That is in 2005, 100 years of the industrial workers of the world. And then sort of went on from there, and Ward has used these books to fundraise, and maybe my most successful might have been their most successful, which was an adaptation of Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S. We called it a People's History of American Empire, largely written by Dave Wagner, who had been a leader of the newspaper strike in the 70s, and drawn by Mike Konopacki, who remains to this day a notable political cartoonist on the scene locally.
And brand new, coming out, in fact, just out last week, I think, Eugene V. Debs, a graphic biography. And we have an excerpt from that on the Progressive Magazine website at progressive.org. And there'll be a program about that book coming up on A Public Affair in April with Alan Ruff. So stay tuned for that.
Thanks so much.
Perhaps you were a reader of Radical America in the day. Perhaps you were a reader of some of these radical comics. Perhaps you have just discovered, Paul, you and I together did a thing for the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, which included a comic of young people first discovering SDS on the internet. So maybe you've just discovered this new artwork on the internet. Let's talk about these comics. And in the introduction, you talk about some of my favorites of the non-radical comics days, Classics Illustrated and Mad Magazine, as being sort of, in some ways, kind of inspirations. In some ways, the radical comics were responses to these. And also the Sergeant Fury comics, which are parodied in this edition of Radical America comics. And I have to note, as a side note, it was interesting that Sergeant Fury had a resurgence as a CIA agent, Nick Fury, in later years. So the comic industry keeps those myths alive. But what about radical comics as a response to the world of commercial comics?
Well, curiously enough, I wasn't quite old enough, but 1952 to 55, when I was 11. EC Comics had a wonderful, wonderful series of action war comics, which very frequently were actually anti-war because they were about the civilian suffering between and, in a way, about the pointlessness of war. They had another series of science fiction comics, many of which were about how would people live in a world that had been destroyed by nuclear weapons, if they could live at all, and other sorts, and Mad Comics, which became Mad Magazine in 1955. Well, all this comic stuff was sort of repressed by the introduction of the Comics Code. Only the superheroes and Classics Illustrated and a few other Donald Duck things really survived from that collapse, the repression and collapse. But we look back upon EC Comics and its greatest creator, Harvey Kurtzman, as progenitors, as people we idolized. And in fact, I and Dennis Kitchen of Wisconsin fame wrote together a biography of Harvey Kurtzman. He was, for both of us, a sort of childhood hero. I would say, of course, we were responding to the foolishness and tedium of most mainstream comics, including the superhero comics that seem so stiflingly dull. But I think that the underground comics were also a response to new art forms that had begun appearing, new ways in which art was used in murals in relationship, or posters in relationship to social movements. Suddenly, comic characters didn't have to appear within the panels. They could jump out of panels. And all kinds of other artistic expressions, which now and then had been used by a few extremely great comic artists, but as a matter of form, really had never been adopted. Someone said that the great art, abstract art experiments of 1912 didn't get to comics until 1965. And I think that's generally true. It was a genre of publications that assumed its readers had minds of children. And then suddenly in 1970, when war and environmental destruction and so much else was on the horizon, young artists began taking up comics because it was a format in which they could express themselves.
Now, you had an interesting comment in the introduction where you talked about the underground press in general as being, and you said, these papers could be called, without exaggeration, the most singularly innovative media since the introduction of television. Now, comics being an important part of that, let's talk about that innovation and the effect that it had on the culture.
Well, it's interesting to me. I happen to be writing something about the history of pulp magazines, which from the 1910s through the 1950s, there were thousands of them. In fact, comic books often had a circulation of 250,000 per issue, 12 issues a year. So people went to a drugstore or someplace, and I can remember this, of being perhaps 100 different magazines, Hollywood gossip magazines, magazines about women's fashions, magazines about cars. You see some small fragment of this today, but multiply that by 500, and you can get an idea of what pulp magazines were as leisure reading before television. The radio hadn't cut down on them so much, and also alongside them paperbacks, which really don't appear until the early 1950s. These are all leisure reading. But by 1970, much of it was fading because of the omnipresence of the television set. So suddenly, journalism and other forms of expression had to make a major adjustment, and it's fascinating that underground newspapers would appear. They had to appear because of the necessity of young people responding to the war emergency, also to the importance to them frequently of marijuana and of premarital sex and all that, those other things in the so-called youth culture. But they also could appear because newsprint on a web press was produced so cheaply that a newspaper could pay for itself by selling 500 copies for 25 cents each. Also remembering rents were very low in those days. So on an absolute level of near poverty, it was possible to bring out these publications. Nobody was making a salary. Another point, everybody was volunteering and enthusiastic about the feeling of creating something new and being able to, as I did, go to the University Mall and hawk these wonderful anti-war publications and get young people and other people to come right up and buy them and get excited about them and read the poetry as they look at the pictures and the anti-war coverage.
We have a caller on the air with a question for you, Paul. And hello, Mike, you're on the air.
Thanks for this opportunity, but I had some questions about, I was a student at the time at the university, and how the book addresses like the subjects of Martin Luther King being shot and Bobby Kennedy, and then also Gene Parks was very vocal at this time. I remember him making announcements on the city county building steps, and he was very fiery. And is there anything in the comic?
In this particular comic, it really was created entirely by Gilbert Shelton and his fellow artists in San Francisco. So actually the cover is Lester Maddox, who was the governor of Alabama?
Mississippi?
One of those southern states who swore that if anyone entered his picnic restaurants, he owned them, that they would be bashed, that is a person of color, they would be bashed over the head with an axe handle. And so in this comic, there's a science fiction style flying saucer with a science fiction style armed chicken, full size, 6 feet tall, asking Lester Maddox, "Do you serve chickens here?" It was a satire on the racism that remained at the center of Southern life, and segregation that remained very much alive at that point. Really, the social themes in this comic are principally about the war. That was a central issue to us. And also FBI repression of drugs, among other things, and just generally how young artists saw the world around them.
And to correct myself, Georgia, Lester Maddox
That's
was the
right,
governor
of
Georgia.
Of course.
And then later, of course, ran as running mate with, didn't he run as running mate with George Wallace?
I don't think so.
No, okay, sorry.
We're close. That's all right.
I remember seeing him dashing out the front door of a hotel in Chicago in August of 68. And you know, it's funny, in the introduction to the PM Press Radical America Comics, they talk about, you know, Austin, they talk about San Francisco, they never mention Wisconsin. And the first thing I thought to myself was, where's Wisconsin in this story? But of course, Wisconsin is very much a part of the legacy of Radical Comics, both.
And not only Radical Comics, because the Chicago Tribune was an innovator, a huge innovator in the 1920s. Wisconsin artists, people from Wisconsin who moved to Chicago, played a big role in this, including the artist from Toma, who has a statue dedicated to him in Lake Geneva, the Statue of the Gump. Another local artist living in Lake Geneva at the time were the two top artists who produced these comics that had continuity day to day. So that's part of a big history. And then that big history, which continues into the 1920s and 1930s a bit, really picks up again in the 1960s and 1970s, because Dennis Kitchen creates a whole line of comics, the first gay comics ever produced in the U.S., all kinds of wonderful experiments in comic art until he closes operation around 1990, one of the most innovative of all. And then we get further in the Wisconsin story and we get to Linda Berry, among
right.
others. So the comic arts great today, our very own Linda Berry, who's from Wisconsin and has returned to us. So there's a big comic history story in Wisconsin, and I'm happy to have developed it in a very illustrated volume. This is actually running low on stock. So if you want to get comics in Wisconsin, this would be the time to get one.
In the opening pages of this, you do quite a bit of sort of history of how this publication came about. And I want to talk a little bit more about that and the role of both Radical America magazine and the Underground Press in supporting the movement by giving people information. Because, you know, so many people don't know our history here in the United States, don't know what is, you know, how did we get into this particular war? How did we get into this particular relationship with this foreign government and so on? And you really put these stories out there to people. One thing that you say in the introduction here that I liked is you say the comic may be understood as an important source of history telling. So talk about that. Talk about radical comics as a way of giving people information to make them better educated to participate in the struggles.
Well, here's a wonderful example. One of the artists in this comic, a guy named Jack Jackson, a real Austin, Texas character. He left San Francisco early in the 70s, went back to Texas, and drew four or five full-length books about the history of Texas, mostly before statehood, but also after, and was recognized by the Texas Historical Association as one of the great explainers of Texas history and all of its cruelty and dynamism. He played a very big role in helping people understand history. Of course, the iconic book in history, comics uses history, is Art Spiegelman's book, Mouse, a way of understanding his father's life being a Holocaust survivor. A tremendously important contribution to a historical understanding. And a number of the other artists that emerged in the 1990s and just beyond include one that I'm working with now, a guy named Joe Sacco, who trekked around the Middle East and other places in danger of getting himself shot or worse in order to explain in a very direct and personal way what it was like to be in the Balkans during the wars or what it's like to be in the West Bank under pressure from the Israelis, bringing history alive and dramatic and bringing it very much right up to date. Now, for me, thinking about the war dangers, I think about the Eugene V. Debs comic, because the most dramatic chapter in some ways, as I wrote it and Noah Van Sciver drew it, was Debs's persecution during the First World War. For the very first time, it was to be made in modern American society, post-Civil War society, it was a crime to resist the U.S. going into a war. And Debs did resist. He was imprisoned. And in prison in 1920, he got 1 million votes running as a socialist. Because there was a very large population, including a considerable portion of Wisconsin, that was opposed to U.S. entry in the First World War, that intuited this war would lead to more other worse wars, and that the baloney served up by the noted liberal President Woodrow Wilson, also an ardent racist, was going to harm the world in so many ways, and not even slightly resemble the great liberal promises of the war to end wars and America's benevolent role in the world and all that other nonsense as an excuse for the U.S. seizing control of the global economy and deciding what decisions would be made.
And, of course, our own magazine, The Progressive, then under its name La Follette's Weekly, was a staunch opponent of U.S. entry into World War I during that period as well.
That's right. And though the bravery of that anti-war movement, in a way closer to the mainstream of American society than the youthful, hippie, anti-war but also anti-racist movements of the 60s were somehow, as important as they were could be depicted as being outside somehow or other, whereas the anti-war movement in the 1910s was very much inside, very much a working class movement. And the power of the state to repress is never to be forgotten or underestimated.
And we have John on the line. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hey, Norm. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Two quick streams of thought. One, I'm just wondering, with Stan Lee's death last year, there were a lot of his works that I think were racial justice oriented. We're essentially using kind of superhero metaphors as a means of understanding people who are the other in our society and holding them up in a noble way. I wonder if that's something that you've thought about. In terms of LGBT comics, I wonder how familiar are you with the work of graphic novels done by Alison Bechdel, who also now is written this, play for Broadway, Fun mm-hmm. Home, which really pioneers a lot of things. In some ways, it's kind of reminiscent of an Addams Family type mm-hmm. Ethos.
Yeah.
Dykes were Watch Out For, was her comic that I think really had an impact. Just last thought, Brian Ponce, who works out at Outreach now, was both my housemate and my colleague. He does a lot of LGBT-related stuff, mm-hmm. Pride comics.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that's a genre in which young people see themselves
absolutely.
In a positive light in ways that they would not ordinarily see each other.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. Alison Bechdel actually appears in comics in Wisconsin, not because she was in Wisconsin, but because Dennis Kitchen was publishing gay comics up there to our north. You ask about Stan Lee, and whereas superheroes stopped interesting me when I was about 10 years old in 1954, nevertheless, my younger friends tell me that in the 1990s, the comic line that Stan Lee oversaw, he didn't actually do any writing or drawing by that time, but the line that he oversaw very wisely took a direction of finding sort of prototypical superheroes that had neurotic responses to the world for very good reasons. They were gay, they were non-white, a whole variety of other things. And those comics had a new appeal to an alienated generation that had quite an effect. As I say, I'm outside that comic world. But I can easily appreciate it. I also want to mention Howard Cruz, who was one of the most important artists during the AIDS crisis. But he drew a wonderful comic called Stuck Rubber Baby, which was about the civil rights movement and the gay community in the South in the early 1960s. It's sort of thinly autobiographical. And for many years, my students at Brown University, it was their favorite textbook. Of course, it was a comic and not a bunch of words. But that's a great example of history revealed almost literally as a real life story, which isn't to say that Fun Home isn't a real life story, but it's a bit thinner. That is, it's about a family and a father and so forth and so forth.
Just a quick follow-up. The X-Men as the example of a group of mutants in this case who were the other, who were misunderstood by society. Those metaphors for both people of color, LGBT people, people with disabilities, are those powerful things in both comics and graphic novels?
Well, what happened to superheroes also is that suddenly, thanks to the production of films based on the characters, these became mega million-dollar productions, and with all of the accoutrements. My world is a much smaller one. It's sure. the nonfiction world of comics, the historical world of comics. So I don't feel myself competent to judge those things, but I hear about them and I know some of them are very good.
Yeah, I will say that
what you're doing is you're lifting up a form of art that I think is sometimes seen as a kid's needle realm, and it's really important to the kids that see themselves in these depictions. But yeah, it really again, both comics and graphic novels need to be elevated. So I'm really glad you're doing that. Thank you so much. Good to talk with you.
Many thanks. I discovered in teaching that my students read fewer pages every year, and so I could either throw up my hands or I could find a way to adapt to them. And I'm sure music would be as good or better, but the form of art I had in front of me, the one I understood, was creating the comic.
Yeah, I will say that I have over my desk a drawing by Stan Lee about basically immigrants and the welcoming that America offers to people as immigrants, which is so, you know, obviously contemporary today as the person in the White House continues to build walls.
Yeah, yeah.
This book, which is the topic of our conversation today, Radical America Comics, the 50th Anniversary Edition, put out by PM Press, and includes the entirety of that 1969 comic edition, plus a great article by Paul Buell that talks about the history of comics and the history of Radical America magazine, and an introduction as well by Jay Kinney. And Jay says something about you in here, which is nice. He says that Buell played an unsung role in both helping underground comics gain momentum and expanding the limits of the left's interaction with popular culture. It's no small achievement, and it is fitting as well that Buell has spent the last decade packaging graphic novels and histories for an adult market that underground comics helped develop. Radical America Comics sits at the root of all this.
I think I discovered 10 years ago that the average reader of graphic novels is under the age of 30. That may have advanced a bit, but you know what coincides with the 95% of the membership of Democratic Socialists of America? It went from 5,000 to 55,000, and how did it do that? By 50,000 people under the age of 30 joining. So this is a real phenomenon of youth from AOC in Congress to all kinds of developments each day in our political life, which shows we have a vital youth movement going on with a great deal of promise for those of us who are on the other side of 70 and looking and wondering and getting some hope.
And yet, you know, going back 50 years and looking at this edition of Radical America Comics, there's so much that is told here in these pages that could be said today.
I'm afraid that's true. Militarization of society, a repressive apparatus, including the security agencies. One of the satirical comics, The Center Spread, is called The Freaks Fight the Feds to the Finish. And you can, the meth freaks fight the feds to the finish. And you can see Bob Dylan plugging an FBI man full of bullets. Gosh, that's violent. We shouldn't have published it. But it was all in good fun at a moment when the FBI had conspiracies against Martin Luther King and did so many other evil things.
Well, and in fact, later that year, assassinated Fred Hampton.
Indeed,
in
Chicago.
In his apartment.
That's exactly.
In Chicago.
I guess there was nothing we could say about him that would be as bad as they were.
SDS.
It was great. It organized 500,000 young people, and it blew up, and it all happened so fast we hardly knew that it came and went, except that for some of us, it's the largest social movement we've been in until the present day. And when we saw the sudden growth of DSA, we thought to ourselves, well, suddenly we're in a mass movement again, or at least there's the promise of one. We hope we don't blow it this time.
Paul Buell, thank you so much for joining me here today on A Public Affair, as always, and for all of the work that you do. Again, if people are interested in getting more information, your books are produced by many different presses. Is there a single place where people can go, or should they just look on the internet under Paul Buell?
I think that's what you can do. In the case of Radical America Comics and the Debs comic and a forthcoming Herbert Marcuse comic, among others, Room of One's Own is an easy place to see these things.
Very good, very good. And of course, in the Progressive magazine, you can see an excerpt from that brand new Eugene V. Debs graphic biography, which has just come out and which is available in stores locally as well.
Thank you, Norm.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station.